Hello, everyone. This is your host, Manoj Tandon. Welcome to another episode of Dark Rhino Security, Security Confidential. Today, we have another rock star guest who really doesn't need an intro, but we will give him one. He is Mr. Troy Hunt. A lot of you who are listening probably know him well or have heard of him. He is the creator of Have I Been Pwned? He's been in numerous publications from Forbes to Time Magazine to Mashable to ZDNet. I mean, he's trying to do the world a lot of good in cybersecurity. And then when he finds some spare time, what you guys may not know about him is that he is a windsurfer and a snowboarder and a tennis player. So, but with that, thank you, Troy, for being here. Really appreciate you gracing us with your presence today. That's fantastic. We're looking forward to it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we got to start off with, you know, I tell you, the origin story thing is a time-honored favorite here. And everybody loves to know how someone got started. And it's really unique in that in our industry, we've not yet found any cookie-cutter ways of how people got into cybersecurity or InfoSec. So please tell us a little bit about how you got into this world and what happened.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's one of the fascinating things about this industry. People are from so many different backgrounds. I almost feel like mine's a little bit more predictable because I came from a software background. I was a software, I think I still am, given the amount of code I saw, right? Software developer since sort of, oh gee, even pre.com days. Like I got on the web in 95 and started building software. And then I ended up having a bunch of roles, probably most notably, I was at Pfizer for 14 years doing initially software development, and then I looked after our application architecture for Asia Pacific. And during that time, we sort of went through this shift, like many companies do, where they start saying, all of you technical people are expensive. We're going to outsource you. And I believe the term was unburden, which really makes you feel valuable. We're going to unburden the company of you people and outsource it. And I became the person managing the vendors who were doing all the outsourcing. And we would outsource to the cheapest possible markets around Asia Pacific. And you'll never believe what sort of software came back when you do that.
So I believe just, it. I've been in that business before. I can tell you that, it's like opening a fortune cookie. You're not going to know what's going to happen.
I'm still healing. Anyway, so we go through this process and I just kept getting back just egregiously bad software. Everything from the user interface of it to the performance to, of course, the security. And I think there was a little bit of me that just started to enjoy pulling it apart. It's like, how bad is this? Like, how much of a mess is it? What can we find here? So I really started to enjoy the security aspects of it. And I found that particularly around this time, so this would have been late 2000s, I started my blog in 2009, I found that there wasn't a lot of good content for Microsoft.NET developers around security. So I started writing blog posts when I'd see bad security. And I couldn't sort of say, hey, look, we at Pfizer got this really bad software. You know, I couldn't do that. But yeah, it was very much like, here's the anti-pattern, here's the fix for it. And there was a lot of appetite from people for this. A lot of developers out there were like, oh, okay, this is really useful. I didn't know this. You know, I'd write about, say, SQL injection, and I'd go, well, here is how it actually works rather than just here's how to fix it. And I started creating a lot of training material around that and managed to create a bit of a career writing online courses. But at the same time, as I was looking at so much security stuff, I started looking more at data breaches because I thought data breaches were fascinating. They were this view behind the veneer of the service that you are using. And suddenly you get to see the mechanics of how everything works. And you learn all these interesting things. You know, those guys use plain text to store all the passwords, for example. And that was the beginning of Have I Been Pwned? I thought, look, it's just interesting to see this data. I wonder how many people don't know that they have been in a data breach.
Well, and you know, it's sad to say, but even today, there are some people who have stored passwords in plain text.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I was sort of hoping for with Have I Been Pwned is that if you do bad things in your code, you may be found out. Like, even if you think that no one will know, you know, if you have a data breach and all your dirty laundry comes out, actually, Madison was a perfect example of that. Like, we learned fascinating things about the way that business actually worked because the dirty laundry was there in the data.
Wow. Meta. formerly known as Facebook. Well, I got actually have a question about those guys, because I don't know how much better they have gotten. And we'll get into this with identities, because it all revolves around identities. And I don't know that those folks have just figured out just yet. But so Have I Been Pwned was not a commercial project. This was started as a public service.
Yeah, and look, I guess it's the same with many projects that go on to be later successful in terms of either the usage or commercially or whatever other measure you want to apply. But it just began as something which was, hey, this might be fun. Well, actually, there were a couple of things. I mean, part of it was this might be fun. I like building things. And I thought that would be a neat thing. But also, I was trying to, in this role I had at Pfizer, I was trying to drive us very much down a cloud-first, native cloud paradigms kind of route. And Microsoft Azure was very new, and we were very much a Microsoft shop in that part of the world at the time. So I said, okay, well, you know, this makes sense. Let me go and build something on this platform and actually see what it's like. So, and then I can sort of, you know, hopefully bring the organization along with me. Look how awesome this is and how easy this is and how cost-effective it was, which is the only way you can build a big pet project. Right. You know, you don't have any money, so it's got to be easy. And that, to me, satisfied many different needs. It scratched this little itch of building something. It answered the question about am I in a data breach or not. And of course, there was that goal to drag the organization kicking and screaming into the future.
Hey, you know, I'm thankful that you did it. I actually used, I've used Have I Been Pwned in a couple talks that I've done. I did 3 years ago, I'd done a talk for Rotary International, their local chapter here in Pittsburgh. And I had put that up on the screen for the audience as a resource that they should be looking at and utilizing and leveraging in their own cleanup efforts, if you will, of their information.
Awesome. Yeah. It's just amazing that the places it appears. The one that always gets me is when I spend time with law enforcement and they're like, yeah, we use it all the time. So, wow, really? Like, what do you do with it? And a lot of it is things like outreach to community and education. Law enforcement wants people to not reuse their passwords and to not have data breaches and identity theft and other things that are detrimental to individuals and consume a lot of legal time trying to chase down. So it's just really cool to see the different places it's appeared.
And, you know, there's a couple questions I want to ask you about that, but I'm going to pin it for a second, because since you're just doing a service out there and people have the ability to donate, I know the link is there on Have I Been Pwned. This is just you or a couple people. This isn't like, this is a volunteer effort, I take it. So you guys, I'm doing the plug for you. If someone listening wants to help you out a little bit, I think it wouldn't be a bad thing.
Well, yeah, it's sort of a multifaceted answer in that it's mostly me. I started the whole thing. It was 100% me until a few years ago when my wife started getting involved in it. So she does a lot of... She basically does everything that she can, and then I do the things that only I can do. So she's not technical, but she comes to a lot of my talks. She learns, and then we have part of a guy in Iceland. So we've got another Microsoft Most Valuable Professional, a friend, someone we know really well, who devotes some development cycles. But we do also have revenue streams as well, which was never the intention. But we've got product placement from 1Password on the front of the website, because I think that's the best possible thing you can do if you find yourself in a data breach. Go and get a password manager and stop reusing your passwords. We do have some subscription services as well. And that is allowing us to reinvest and build it into a larger, more sustainable thing. We've put a lot of effort in this year in particular into completely rewriting the data tier to be much more sustainable. We really didn't have a good backup and disaster recovery story until now, and we're just about to flick over to something that will allow us to restore to points in time or geo-replicate or do all the sorts of things that you really need such a important part of the internet to be able to do, but you can't do without money either.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. Glad to hear that you guys are going down the sustainable route, and it's you're going to be around for many, many, many years to come, because it is a great service for people who are listening. I don't think anyone that's listening to this show doesn't know about it, but if they do go on that, the amount of data that's available, it's a wealth of it. And I guess let's start with the place with passwords here. And you brought up password managers. So the first question here that comes to mind for me is there any value at all to forcing, let me restate this, is there any practical value, not mathematical value, to forcing a length of a password and forcing a password change at an X period of time? Given the amount of email password combinations that, I mean, everyone's done it. I mean, I've been guilty of it. I mean, everyone has done it. So is there any value to doing that? Or would we not just be better off saying, you know, my password is cat1, cat123, cat1234. At least it's different. So if it gets pawned, it's only getting pawned in one place.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the right question is, what is the right level of impost to impose on people around password strength and criteria? Now, if you have no rules whatsoever, you will get cat1 and you'll get ABC12. You will get all that sort of stuff because we know that empirically from the data. And this is what I was saying earlier on, you know, the data breach is this fascinating glimpse into not just the way a system works, but to the way people work. Some of the very early writing I did was around, hey, look at this. Here's like the Stratfor data breach and the Gawker data breach. And isn't it interesting when the same person is in both, a huge proportion of the time they have the same password. You know, like what are the chances?
Yeah.
So I think people just by human nature will defer to the path of least resistance when they're creating accounts on a website. I mean, they just want to get in there and like buy their t-shirt or, you know, have that extramarital affair or whatever it is that they're on the website to do. Like that's their priority. And they're trying to lower that barrier to entry so that you can't have an entire free-for-all. But then on the other end of the spectrum as well, as a website operator, you've got a business, like you need people to come and sign up and you want to make that as easy as possible because you need to pay developers and servers and marketing, all this sort of thing. So I think we've got to recognize that there are these sort of, I guess, misaligned objectives sometimes. Now, a good example of that, sometimes people say, well, what you should do is never allow someone to choose their own password. You generate a random string for them. And okay. That way there'll never be password reuse. There'll never be credential stuffing attacks. And I'm like, yeah, and then they'll never be customers, right? Because that people hate that. So that the question needs to be where in the middle of those two extremes is the right balance. And the first thing I'd say is I'd argue that this is very dependent on the nature of the service and the demographic of the people using it. If you're building a service for the great masses who may not be technical at all, and the impact of account takeovers is fairly minimal, your approach might be different to if it is the password rules for your own employees and you're also giving them multi-factor tokens and all the rest of it. But as a general rule of thumb, arbitrary password complexity criteria is out the door because it leads to very predictable patterns. You know, there's no good having someone create a password of password and they just capitalize the P and put an at symbol instead of the A and a zero instead of the O. Like there is no value in that. And NIST back in about 2017 came out and said, look, let's get rid of that and start looking instead at things like known bad passwords from previous breach corpuses. If a password has been in a data breach, that's a pretty strong sign it's no good. So one of the things we built and have been pwned was a feature called Pwn Passwords, where we've got hundreds of millions of passwords from data breaches and the prevalence with which they've been seen. And you can query that via an anonymity model and then block the person from using the password if it's bad enough. And that service gets hit just over 8 billion times a month at the moment from services trying to stop bad passwords from appearing. And then your other point here was around mandated password rotation. So we've seen so many times, you know, every 90 days, please rotate your password.
Yeah.
And then we all, and as you said, we've all done it. I did this at Pfizer because I had that policy. We all take that number at the end and we add one and we go, job done. Box ticked, move on, next problem. And of course, that's a very predictable pattern. It is security theater. And part of that guidance from NIST, you know, more than half a decade ago, was stop doing that. There are other things that we can do that are much more resilient to the sorts of attacks that we're worried about. And the landscape has changed as well. Yeah, we're worried about password compromises because back in the day we used to have a lot of unencrypted transport layers. We don't have that anymore. We've now got user behavioral analytics. We've got multi-factor. Yeah. We've got all of these other ways of making accounts more secure that don't require us to do things that just upset customers and really don't work very well anyway.
So I guess this gets to, do you think that there's enough awareness in the market that people would pay for some kind of a premium security feature on these websites? What do you,
well, if we look, I mean, even if we just look at password managers, and of course, password managers can be free and they can be low cost. The real only constant barrier to a password manager is just having to learn something that's a little bit different. And after that, your life is much easier anyway, because password managers are so much easier than typing in even your crappy passwords. You know, they're a wonderful thing. And the adoption rates are single-digit percentages. So clearly the challenge is not just awareness, because I defy you to ask anyone and say, hey, is it a good idea to use the same password everywhere? Because everyone goes, oh, no, I've heard you're not meant to do that. But do you do it? Yeah. Okay. Why? I get a password manager, but it seems like hard work. Now, of course, all of this is until they're in a data breach that actually impacts them, and then suddenly they'll do anything in the world to try and make the problem go away and they'll change their behaviors. But evidently, because of those single percentage adoption rates, people are not sufficiently motivated to make that change. And I think we're pretty much at where the status quo is now until the technology moves long enough and things like pass keys become viable enough for the masses that we start to move away from the password problem.
Yeah, I don't know that. See, this is just my experience. Convenience versus security, convenience wins every time. Nobody wants to be bothered with it. But I think the problem at hand is so serious, because our identities, our digital identities, are tied to so many critical and non-critical services, right? So our email address might be the same one that we use to log into our physician's office website, you know, and that email address might have been pawned, and likely the password there has been pawned as well. That email identity has become almost synonymous with, in many ways, like our driver's license or our passport. You can replicate another human being if you just through open source. I mean, there's no rocket science involved with this. If you are a target of being replicated, you can be cloned in digital space, and then someone can use your identity for nefarious purposes. And there's unfortunately a lot of examples for that.
So, well, you know, the way I think about it is your email address is the primary key to your digital life, right? That is the one thing that joins you across all the platforms, with the exception being people that use sub-addressing or catch-alls on domains and things like that.
Right.
But, you know, we are a very small percentage. In fact, I know how small of a percentage we are, about 0.03% of everyone. So, you know, 1 in 3,000.
Oh, it's really low. I think Apple, I want to say they published, you know, they have the ability to now the emails, you know, anonymize. Yeah, just, I haven't had my cup of coffee yet, and I need another cup. But the adoption rate on that feature is fairly low.
Well, you know, I was looking at a data breach just yesterday, and I was seeing a few more of those, I forget which domain it's on, but a few more of those obfuscated Apple email addresses. I was like, oh, that's okay. That's kind of cool. Yeah, Fastmail does a similar thing. They have a partnership with 1Password where you can obfuscate the email address.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is some value to that. It does break that assertion that I made before about it being the primary key to your digital life. You then, of course, delegate some degree of your privacy to the service provider that can now map you to all of these other places. So you're giving up something to do that. It's also not stopping you and all of your other personal identifiable data, including, if we think about the AT&T incident of recently, your phone number and your date of birth and your social security number. You know, it's if you're in that, and okay, it's nice that you've got an obfuscated email address, but all of the other identifiers still.
But all the other identifiable information, absolutely, yeah. You can still reconstruct me.
Yeah, it's exactly right. So I think a lot of the lesson is all of these controls, whether they be password managers or master email address, whatever they may be, they get you a little bit of the way along the digital privacy continuum. But there's always these other things, right? And I think the question for everyone is just to decide what's the right balance for them.
So then without, what's the role of government policy in this then? Is it not time that we do something be done with?
Oh yeah, every time someone's asked about government and legislation, et cetera, I'm sort of joking, okay, well, which government? Because the reality of it is that we're here on this global platform that is the internet, and we've got a service that might be hosted in one location, and then we've got people spread out all over the world. You just look at any one of these data breaches we have, and you've got a league of nations in there. I mean, it's just about every single country in the world by the time you get a data breach with millions of email addresses in there. So should a government regulate that a platform, let's say such as Facebook, which is such a global thing anyway, are they going to regulate controls around how people need to authenticate? I think at the moment they're having enough trouble just regulating how platforms like that use our personal data. You know, I would imagine something like how people create passwords and authenticate is further down the road. And then, of course, we'll end up in that same old debate of is this stifling innovation if we start to have controls around things like the way technology needs to be built in an otherwise largely unregulated industry. It's not like it's finance or aviation, for example.
Well, in some ways it is, though. It's worse. Because you can...
dying bit if the code goes wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I could turn you into, I'm not saying that we would, I'm just picking on you because you're on the show, but if somebody wanted to replicate Troy Hunt and say, you know, I'm going to turn Troy Hunt, I'm going to create another alternate identity, and I'm going to completely confuse it with the legit Troy Hunt, and I'm going to use his identity to siphon off a whole bunch of free services from the Australian government, then I'll create another bloke over in California that is now for you to undo that is going to be a nightmare. For me to undo it, to me, is going to be a nightmare. So, and I don't think like Meta, you mentioned them, you can't recover an account from them if once it's taken over by a bad guy.
I think the opportunity in terms of legislation is more around the verifiers, particularly for things like government or essential services. I mean, I'll give you an example here. So, yeah, look, it's AT&T, which is...
By the way, did they officially say that they were breached?
Yeah. Pretty. They've used...
Because they've been dancing around that topic.
There's a lot of lawyers writing their messaging at the moment. I have absolutely no doubt about that. In fact, even just before coming on this show, I was sharing information about the number of class actions. They're facing more than 10 class action lawsuits just in Texas alone at the moment. So they're going to be very cautious about everything they say. But the messaging that's come out from them, that I think the two most important things is acknowledging that I think the term they used was there are AT&T data attributes in the breach. They didn't really say AT&T data, and they're trying to establish whether it's from them or from a third-party provider, but they do now seem to have acknowledged that it is information that was given to AT&T that was exposed. And then the other thing, which very clearly indicates some degree of compromise here, is they've gone and rolled a whole bunch of passcodes for, I think, their internet service provider, and that's something you do after suspicion of compromise. So they do seem to acknowledge it. But where I was going with that is that one of the big problems there is that they've got social security numbers, which are a really key part of identity verification in the US. We had a very large telco in Australia about 18 months ago have a data breach where driver's license numbers were exposed. We don't have social security numbers, but a lot of the time we're using driver's license numbers for identity verification. And we had about 11 million people in that. AT&T had about 70 million, but we've only got 25 million people in this country. So for pro rata, probably about the same sort of thing. And then you end up with queues of people around the local main roads and transport authority because they want to renew their driver's licenses because the thing that they use to verify their identity is now floating around there on the internet. And I think the discussion I have here is shouldn't we have better ways of doing identity verification such that just the release of a number, which you have to give to all these parties anyway to verify yourself, is not sufficient to impersonate you?
I'm so glad to hear you say that. I totally agree. What form would that take? Have you any ideas about
it? Well, there's a lot of discussion around things like having government IDs, like central identifiers. But the problem then is people are very worried about giving that information away to the government. They're like, hang on a second, do I want the government to be able to have, the keys to verifying my identity and all of these different services? And then you go, well, yeah, but you know that they have all of this data already, right? Yeah. It's just a question of whether they create an entire platform around it. Many people will point to things like Aadhaar in India and say, look, this was the government's way of doing...
You know what? I actually have that on my list of questions. It wasn't in the ones that Emily sent, but I did put it on my little paper. Let's talk about the Aadhaar, because that's a mess. Oh, man, there's so many flaws in that system. Okay. So first of all, they've had multiple leaks of information. They've had multiple leaks of top government officials that have been embarrassed by their own data being leaked. Do you know that in the Aadhaar system, there's no way to delete an identity? So okay. I'll give you an example. I lost my dad a few years ago, and we can't delete his identity. He has to show up at the office with his fingerprint to delete it. Now, so now I could have an 82-year-old, I could recreate that identity, and that person lived in the United States for a while. So we could absolutely recreate portions of his U.S. identity. And now instead of him, who is no longer on this earth, it could be somebody else with a completely legit document set that is traveling all over the planet.
Yeah, and his identity. I mean, I find these discussions fascinating because the mind tends to sort of go, well, what can you do with that and what would the impact on the individual be? And if it was someone impersonating a deceased person, the impact on the victim is obviously non-existent, but does it impact their family or is it just simply a flaw in the system that could allow people to get away with stuff we wouldn't want them to?
You could, because he was eligible for Social Security here. So if I want to commit Social Security fraud, let's resurrect an identity, recreate it.
Yeah, but I wonder in that case, who is the victim? Because it's not your father. It's no longer his problem.
No, it's not his. He could care less, obviously.
Yeah. So, you know, as soon as you said Aadhaar, I remembered so much of the discussion around that 2018 period as it was coming out, that the sense that I constantly got was that the government themselves really didn't have a good grasp on how these things work. And the quote that I was looking for here was from the Attorney General. And the title, I just found this news story, Aadhaar data is protected by 13 feet high, 5 feet thick walls, says the Attorney General.
Oh,
and Twitter goes berserk. Well, you put it behind a wall. Good on you, mate. That'll work.
That person has no clue. I did not know that quote, but obviously they have zero clue about cybersecurity.
Well, and you know, in fairness, because we keep coming back to governments and interpretation, one of our we've had a lot of ex-prime ministers lately, but one of our ex-prime ministers, as we're talking about the encryption debate, around the fact that encryption can be used to protect communications that we don't want people having, yeah, terrorism, this sort of thing. And he got asked by a journalist, he said, look, you're talking about controls on encryption or banning encryption. Encryption is just mathematics. How do you expect to ban mathematics? And he said, look, that the laws of mathematics are admirable, but the only law that matters here is the law of Australia. So, come on, that doesn't make any sense. It's just not how any of this works.
Yeah. I mean, you look at terrorism is a great example of misuse of the Aadhaar system, because at any given time, you look at the death rate in the society. If you need a terrorist with a new identity, why not just go to India?
Well, I think
because we know that that identity exists. It was never deleted.
Yeah, and you know that's part of the risk. But very often this comes back to the moral neutrality of technology. So if the debate is around something like encryption or how do we protect data, you know, these things can be used for good purposes and are mostly used for good purposes. But the technology is morally neutral. It can be applied in negative ways. And the challenge we have to deal with is how do we make it work and practical to do all the good things without making it too easy to enable the bad things, but not letting the bad things stop us from doing the good things, you know, particularly around the encryption debate. Should we stop people being able to have secure and private communication because it could also be used to talk about nasty things?
I mean, that debate happened here a long, long, long time ago in the early 90s. If you remember, and I forget the name of the gentleman who invented PGP. Remember that? pretty good privacy.
Well, I think we're back to like clipper chip sort of thing again as well, right? Where it's like, let's not have a situation where we can have communication go unmonitored. Let's have a way of monitoring and then that become a total mess. That's the example that always comes back up again.
So, well, let me run a thought by you. What about having the ability as an individual to say that for my identity, there's an opt-out, just like in the US, you can, with your credit rating, you can lock your credit. So now it becomes a real pain in the backside because you can no longer go and just, you know, get a new phone or buy a car or do any of the things that you would do with credit. It needs an additional level of verification. But could we do that with the identity, say that this individual does not accept electronic identity as a mechanism for authentication of their identity or verification of their person?
Well, I guess, first of all, we'd have to have a consistent means of doing identity verification electronically through some government resource, which could then honor any sort of opt-out request. But maybe that would make sense. But it's so far down the line before we get to the point where we can do digital identity verification reliably without just like, hey, here's my social security number and my address. maybe that would make sense if we ever get to that point.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have a good solution for this. And this is a topic that comes up and it seems like it's a topic that's come up in your world all the time. There's no easy thing. And, you know, some people have said, why not push it on the likes of Meta or WhatsApp? Because like in both their instances, if your identity is compromised and then that is used to compromise your account, you can't actually recover that account.
But even then, if it was identity verification via some sort of centralized government resource, which government? And I asked it almost rhetorically because everyone always goes, oh, the American one. It's like, oh, well, okay, sure. But that's like 6% of the world. You know, that's a tiny, tiny slice. And you've got a global platform with 2 billion plus people on it. So do we just end up with more balkanization of the way these services work? As if it wasn't already enough of a mess with the likes of GDPR and everything else, you know, do we really want to just keep dividing things down? And we're never going to get a unified global solution. So I almost wonder if we kind of keep ending up in a model, going back to the full circle with the passwords things, where it is flawed, but given all of the various constraints at the moment, it's the best thing that we can possibly do right now.
And we accept it. Okay, well, that is one part of the risk equation, right? You can mitigate it. You can transfer it, or you can accept it. Those are the only three things that can be done with risk.
I say this slightly tongue-in-cheek, but the number of times I sit here, particularly with good friends in the industry, and we talk about this, and we're like, we just don't have any good answers. Gee, it's a good time to be in this industry, isn't it? Because there are so many problems like this.
There are. And you know what? It is actually a good time. I can't say that there's a boring day in our world. It's always something fascinating. And the ingenuity of the bad actors, you know, you're not talking about run-of-the-mill criminals here. You're talking about people who are fairly sophisticated a lot of times and their technical capabilities and trying to understand the flaws in a system to exploit it.
Keeps it interesting.
It keeps it. It does keep it interesting. Okay. So on, I guess with the identities, you know, another big trend that I'd love to get your opinion on is 2FA. You know, what is the effectivity of it, given some of the breaches we've seen where the hashes and you can actually replicate a person browsing the same with the same 2FA authentication as somebody else, and then you bypass 2FA. Probably didn't say that right, but I think you know what I'm talking about. But
I think we've got to recognize it as one of these controls where when it's done well on behalf of both the platform and the individual, it does make a substantial difference. I mean, if we just look at the rate of credential stuffing attacks just feels like every other week there's some big news story about, hey, such and such a company has been hacked. And they're like, no, we haven't been hacked. It's just a hacker logging in with thousands and thousands of legitimate email addresses and passwords. And it kills that sort of stuff dead. Even SMS-based 2FA kills that sort of stuff dead, because the barrier between some automated en masse testing millions of accounts and getting straight in with no 2FA versus having to get the SMS, oh, now I've got to go and hijack someone's SIM, or I've got to go and social engineer them. Like, it massively changes that equation, which is fantastic. We still see risks in other ways, though. And a couple of things come to mind. There was a data breach recently of a service called Spoutable. Have you heard of Spoutable?
I have not.
All right. So this is like an alternate social media platform. You know, when Elon went a little bit crazy a while ago and a bunch of people were like, yeah, we're leaving Twitter and we're going to, you know, Mastodon or Blue Sky or things like this.
Right.
There was a platform stood up called Spoutable, which was meant to be the, I guess, the alternative. And they recently had an incident that someone then took a lot of advantage of and sent all the data to me for having been pwned, where there was an API that would normally return someone's, let's say, the social information that you should see on the platform. It would be their name, their handle, the number of posts I've made. Except their API returned pretty much everything in the database, their bcrypt hash of their password. There was a reset token in there you could just go and reset the password with. But they also returned the 2FA secret. So you could take that secret and you could generate your own 2FA codes. So it completely invalidated all of the 2FA on the platform. And I guess the point I'm making here is that it's got to, and then this was just an egregiously bad example, but 2FA alone is not the solution. You've got to have it actually implemented properly. We've seen things like last year, the Genesis Market takedown. So Genesis Market was a marketplace where you could buy cookie material and browser fingerprints in order to replicate the authentication tokens of a victim. And all of this is set post-auth. So, you know, you put in your email address, put in your password, put in your 2FA token, you get material back in cookies, and often it's fingerprinted to the browser. But if you've got a compromised machine and bad guys can actually grab that, then they can put it on a website and you can go through and purchase that.
Yep.
But I think it's almost a good thing that a service like that has to exist, because that's a lot of extra mucking around to go through, and it only works if someone's machine is compromised as well. You know, compared to, well, I just got a username and a password off any old data breach and it works everywhere. So it massively raises the barrier to entry, but it's also not infallible.
Which brings us to AI. You can't have a cybersecurity conversation without talking about AI. I mean, I guess it's an obligatory thing. With the advancements in NLP, what do you think that's going to do for the future in terms of not these technical breaches, but we saw MGM get breached recently. As you saw, they called the service desk and were able to gain access and whatnot, or using natural language processing to learn the formats of purchase orders and checks and procedures, and then replicating all that, you know, spoofing the email what was it recently? Wasn't there a bank out of Hong Kong that lost $25 million because of deep fakes on a Zoom call that the gentleman thought were real, and he transferred the bank's money?
Well, I think there's several different ways of looking at this, and I'll start with the observation from before about the moral neutrality of the technology. And it's up there with encryption that way. Obviously, we can do wonderful things with it. We can also do bad things. I think what I'm finding fascinating at the moment, because of the extraordinary rate of development of AI, is trying to separate what is actually interesting and relevant to what is absolute rubbish. And the example I was just trying to find here, so that this was January 31 this year, I was tweeting about this. Europcar had allegedly had a data breach. So someone posted a whole bunch of data to a hacking forum. So this is from Europcar. And it just looked a little bit odd. And it turned out that all of the data was generated. It wasn't real. And we probably should have understood when you start to look at some of the data in here, because every city of birth was kind of weird. New Austin Land. New Peter Hayden. Now, there's a lot of places in the world I've never heard of before. So, yeah, maybe a little bit legit, but North Courtney. And it just seemed to be like compass directions and then someone's name. Anyway, the thing that made it really interesting is Europcar said, this is ChatGPT AI-generated data.
Okay.
And I just looked at it and went, what makes this AI? And then to make it even worse, some InfoSec company picked it up and some executive there, obviously, who has a PR company, shipped around this big spiel about how all this is AI and we've got to be careful of the AI. And we offer services to help you be careful of the AI. Anyway, went and pulled through all the threads on it. And it eventually turned out to be from a Python library, which just simply generates words. No artificial intelligence whatsoever in this. So I'm finding it quite amusing to look at all of this and figure out, like, what is actual AI doing really cool AI stuff, either for good or for bad, and then what is everyone wanting to have a slice of the AI pie and get their 5 minutes of fame?
Well, there's a lot of both, actually.
This was fascinating, this one. The cybersecurity company that was shopping it around said that apparently they're a company that specializes in simulating the attacks of cyber criminal groups, and they likened the incident to a Scooby-Doo plot. It's a slow news day, isn't it? Someone's after headlines.
Well, they got it. I didn't pick up on that story, but now I know about it.
But it well, I tell you what, I gave them a lot of press. It wasn't good press, but they got a lot of press.
Oh, we just haven't even lit the candle with AI yet as to what's going to happen. In many ways, it's a good thing because, things don't change. People don't change unless a overwhelming force is imposed upon them in some way, shape, or form. And AI is definitely an overwhelming force in many regards. And it's making strides into so many sectors of our lives at such a rapid pace. I mean, you just look at it, unrelated area, medicine, its ability to read pathology reports. You know, it can look at x-rays and MRIs and determine with a high degree of certainty if someone has a type of disease. It's pretty remarkable how quickly the adoptions are happening. And those are all really good things. You don't have to wait 5 weeks for a result or, several days for a result. But how it's going to get used then for nefarious purposes, I think, the deep fake example out of Hong Kong is only the beginning.
Okay, well, look, it's a fun time. And I think as much as I like to specialize in security stuff, I'm a nerd at heart, and I love seeing all of this stuff. I love seeing all of these technologies and all of these use cases. I love having the new shiny things. And some of it's going to go wrong. this is the way it's always been, right?
So what is your recommendations, Troy, to the average person listening to this show? What should they be doing? What is some hygiene that you would absolutely say, guys, if you're going to do nothing, at least do this?
So the discussion I've been having with the average person is to liken it back to an incident we had IRL in real life here recently, where we left our car outside and I accidentally forgot to lock the door. Now, I don't normally leave it outside. It's normally in a garage. I always lock the – I forgot to lock the doors. And sure enough, someone came by that night and broke into – i.e. opened the door. The police said it's breaking into because they weren't authorized. Anyway, they opened the unlocked door, went in there and did no damage and stole a pocket knife in the glove box. Like, that was the full extent of it. But the observation there, we later on had some video footage of other people doing similar things. We could see people driving along the street. Someone would be driving the car. The passenger would lean out. They'd try the door handle. Nah, no good. Go to the next one. Try the door handle. Nah, no good. Literally, that is how opportunistic it is. And it's very much the same thing with cybersecurity, where the vast majority of people who experience any sort of digital attack against them, it's opportunistic, taking advantage of low-hanging fruit. It is reused credentials. It is phishing emails. It is the sort of very, I guess, opportunistic behavior that we see IRL, the same things happening online. If you have a password manager and your password is unique, you are out of the 90%+ of the category of other people who are reusing them everywhere. If you have multi-factor authentication turned on, you're also out of that whole group. If you're not going through and entering your details when you get a text message about your package that's gone missing, you're out of that group. And it is really the low-hanging fruit that's consistently susceptible to this, and it's so easy not to be the low-hanging fruit.
Don't be that. What about for companies?
Yeah, it's harder. I'm very fond of the saying that as a company or even as a software developer, you have to get it right every single time, and the hacker only has to get it right once. Right. You know, it's almost like a bit of a power imbalance. And I think what's very hard for companies is that there are so many moving digital parts these days. It wasn't that long ago where there might be a publicly facing corporate website, and that would be it, and then everything else would be internal and behind the firewall and some degree out of reach compared to everything else. There are now so many different services that company run on so many different platforms, and that might be everything from their own custom apps spread across different cloud services through to the number of different SaaS solutions that we all use. You know, the number of people that have accounts on everything from the invoicing system through to the let's say the help desk system. All these things are online, publicly facing, and the really hard thing for the company is just keeping track of all of these things. It's fascinating also to see how much burden companies then have to put on the service providers. We were having a discussion just this morning, my wife and I, because a very well-known technology company wants to use this Have I Been Pwned service. It starts at $3.95 a month. And they gave us a 250-question questionnaire about everything from SOC 2 compliance to your last audits to the processes for disposing of a mobile device after it has reached end of life. So companies try and put a lot of this burden back on the service providers to then justify all their security controls. And you just end up with this like massive spider web of different relationships and possible points of ingress. I'm honestly sympathetic to companies. It's a very hard problem to manage.
It is. And third-party risk is probably one of the largest growing segments of risk.
And hey, that may be the AT&T vector as well. You know, when they're sort of saying we can't see compromise, it may be someone they've used, but they're still going to be on the hook for it. That, you know, they're the ones getting targeted by the lawsuits right now, not the as yet unnamed third party, if that is what happened.
It happened in the Okta breach as well, right? That was a third party, right?
Yeah, and it's over and over and over again. It is a trusted party. But I think, again, that the challenge is who is on the hook when your trusted party has an incident?
Well, and it gets really complicated with, you mentioned, people having early on, you mentioned briefly illicit affairs. I think Ashley Madison, when it got compromised, there were people who lost their lives, quite honestly. And that's terrible. There should be, now who's responsible?
And yeah, that's a very messy one. I mean, that's always going to be the one of the most sensational examples because of the actual impact on human life. I mean, it's one thing to have your credit card defrauded. It's another thing for someone to take their lives. And of course, that's extraordinarily messy because it's all tied up in that whole sort of moral view of the purpose people were there for and what would then cause them to take an action like that. But it is a good reminder that sometimes data breaches can have really serious real world impact.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure there are cases of extortion where data that was stolen got out on someone and then that was used to force them to do things that they didn't want to do.
But we do see this very often now. I mean, that happened a lot with Ashley Madison where the individuals got blackmailed. And because the data was spread around so broadly, anyone who wanted to get into the blackmail business had a great big list of people who felt really, really guilty. And even in very recent years, I mean, Ashley Madison was 2015. Yeah. As recently as last year, I've had people sending me blackmail attempts from that. And we're seeing this pattern over and over again. A couple of years ago, it was Vastamo, the Finnish psychotherapy site. If someone tried to ransom them, didn't get anywhere. So they went through and they ransomed the individuals.
Wow.
You know, send us money or your psych records are going to be released. And eventually they were all released anyway. It's just, it's a horrendous business model. We see the same thing happening with ransomware crews now. You know, I mean, ransomware used to be just encrypt all the files and then you pay to get the key. And then it became, encrypt all the files, but we've got a backup. So you've got to pay to decrypt and pay so that we delete, honestly, we'll delete it, delete our copy. And now it's like, okay, well, we're going to go after the individuals in here as well and tell them that they need to pay. It's just, it is horrendous. And I think that's an industry that prevails because of the ubiquity of the amount of data that's out there and the ease of which someone anywhere in the world in a largely anonymous fashion can go after innocent victims.
Oh, absolutely. And then a lot of the bad actors, some of them are really beyond the approach of law because they're residing in nations that you just can't go and get them.
Well, around the same time that we had that telco incident I mentioned before, that 18 months ago, we had our largest private health insurer, Medibank, got ransomed. And the ransomware crew there started dumping very, very personal data about individuals once they didn't get the ransom payment. They started by dumping a list of people that had abortions. And then they went on to people that were getting psychotherapy or drug and alcohol treatment. But to your point here, only last month, the Australian government did name the person they believe was responsible for it. And of course, it's someone in Russia. And if he ever comes to Australia, he's going to be in a lot of trouble, you know. But the problem is that the guy's probably going to be holed up there pretty much forever. But you'd have to imagine it would be very difficult for him to do very much at all of interest there, particularly in the criminal underworld, given how well known he is now. So maybe it's one of these things where even if we can't get the person back into a jurisdiction they can be charged and jailed, at the very least, you can make their life as hard as possible.
Yeah, and see, and if they're a proxy for a state operation, then it becomes troublesome. And again, so there's limited. We had an FBI agent on a couple episodes ago, and he wrote a book, The Four Truths of Cybersecurity. Right. And one of those truths that he expounded was that it's rare, you know, that these bad actors go to jail. We hear about the big ones, but a large part of it, they don't, you know, that's why it continues to flourish. But hey,
it's crazy, isn't it?
You know, Troy, I know we're at the hour here. I wanted to give you a chance to plug whatever it is that you'd like to plug and let our audience know about in your world.
Yeah, password managers. Go and get password managers. Look, you know, people know where to find me. TroyHunt.com, have I been pwned? You know, that's pretty much the entirety of what I do these days. So,
are you doing any presentations anywhere? Are you appearing?
Yeah, I always am. I'm doing so the next big one I have coming up, I'm doing a keynote at NDC Oslo in June. And, you know, the one I'm really excited about is I'm going to be doing a joint talk with my 11-year-old daughter in Oslo about 3D printing.
Wow.
Which has nothing to do with cybersecurity, but she has really gotten into it. So she's going to do her first talk in front of hundreds and hundreds of technology professionals and actually teach them stuff that they don't know about 3D printing. So we're on the countdown. We've got 2 and a bit months for that, and we're working really hard to turn that into an awesome talk.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. I think she's pretty stoked about it, actually.
That sounds like a great time, and it sounds like I'm glad you're able to find the time to do things like that, because that sounds like genuine fun.
Well, you know, I say yes to everything, and then I figure it out later on, and I regret saying yes to it. I don't regret saying yes to that. It's you work it out.
Well, and Troy, we'll put a link to your blog as well. Thank you for joining us all the way from halfway around the world. And don't be a stranger here. If you ever want to let our listeners know something, always welcome back.
Cool. Thanks, Manoj.